This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on April 3rd, 2016. This week, Kate and Nick joined me, Mike Rappin, to discuss comic book marketing and summer events. Once again, we talked about DC Rebirth, but from a slightly different angle. One more note before we start the show, our new website is up and running. If you're hearing this episode, then your RSS feed updated and everything is good. You can check out our brand new site at ircb.us. Leave comments on our episodes and keep an eye out for more content from our hosts. And now, this week's episode. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief of Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two fantastic human beings, Kate Scotchless.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey.
Thank you both for joining me. I'm super excited that you're here. As always, you're two amazing people, and I love talking to you about comic books. And speaking of comic books, what did you both read last week?
So I have had all the reading time this week and have plowed through quite a few trades. I read Volume 4 of Ms. Marvel, which is the Last Days trade, and goes issues 16 through 19, and it's completely amazing, and I can see why it's up for all the awards.
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed that book.
Yeah, it was just so saying. Good. And it then tainted all the stuff that came after it, because nothing was quite as good as that.
Right.
And so then Nick strong-armed me into buying a bunch of Archer and Armstrong during a Comixology sale. So I read volumes 1 through 3. So that was 14 issues of the 2012 run of Archer and Armstrong, mm-hmm. Which the writing is really solid the whole time. It's Van Lett through all of it, but then it's a different artist for every arc. And the first one's good. The second one's okay. And the third one's amazing. So that was fun. But then the big thing I read this week was Faith number 3, which I just damaged as I had sitting out here. And so I'm probably going to go get another copy of. Yeah, I set it on my table to talk about. And it stuck to something. I didn't realize there was goop on my table. So, you know, tears were shed. I'll probably go to the shop tomorrow. On that note, that is the Jody Hauser book from Valiant. And I am really hoping that publishers are getting the message here loud and clear, where this book is just selling out like hotcakes and like just record breaking all over the place for how many republishings they're doing so quickly. And it's certainly not because everyone was really into Harbinger, and it's certainly not because everyone knew all about Faith already and was hungry for more story. It's because they've come up with something, you know, diverse body types and realistic characters, and it's not all sexy all the time, and it is not dark and moody. Are you paying attention, DC? It's not dark and moody. So it has just been a really, really great story, and this is the second to last issue, so I'm really hoping that they keep going with this success and come out with more of the story, especially from this particular creative team. It's Jody Hauser with Francis Portella and Marguerite Sauvage,
I think.
There we go. Okay.
I believe she's a French-Canadian.
So what they have is one artist for the main parts. And then the other artist does like these fantasy sequences when Faith is like imagining stuff in her head. And it is so perfect. And it's charming, but also serious and tackles some pretty serious issues. But so it doesn't feel like a children's comic is what I'm getting at. Because sometimes when you get these comics that are like feel good, they're also all ages and are doing, they don't make you think much. And that's not this book at all. So that was...
Oh, yeah. I've only heard super positive things about this book, like from all parts of the internet. So that's super cool to hear.
Yeah. Also, Jody Hauser, follow her on Twitter. She's a freaking gem. So on that note, how about you, Mike?
Oh, well, for me this week, I read a bunch of digital comics. I've been trying to catch up with all this backlog of the last 2 or 3 weeks. Books that I just ignored, such as Uncanny X-Men. I read issues number 3 through 5. Three, 4, and 5. And I'm not sure if I hate or love this book. It's a series that it constantly rubs me the wrong way, and yet I want to keep reading it because it involves some storylines that I'm really interested in. I really like Greg Land's art on this book. So this is a series by Cullen Bunn and Greg Land. And Cullen Bunn's writing is okay. But Greg Land's art really just pulls me out of this series, so it really, it's just bothering me. I just wanted to say that. I also read Ringside number 5, which was a lot of fun. I'm actually getting back into this series now that they're starting to do a little bit more with the wrestling side of the story, which is what I was saying I really wanted. So that's been good. Yeah, and I mean, I hope that Paul stuck around with this too, because he's, I feel like he's the only other person that I can ask wrestling questions about, and he'll actually have the answer. otherwise, I also read Kennel Block Blues, which is this series from Boom. It's this really weird story about, it's not weird so much as it's just about like a jail. It's about a dog that goes to jail, but the jail is called a kennel, and there's all these cats and dogs and a couple different types of animals. There's like a lizard and a rabbit. And
wasn't
and
it I essentially think, that it was going to the pound, but the pound is doggy prison?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's called it's the kennel.
Yeah.
And it's very goofy. It's like the main character sees the world, or tries to see the world, in like this Disney style like happy-go-lucky fun time, but what actually is happening is these awful, you know, jail-like things where, you know, people are being sent to solitary, or they're being put down, mm-hmm. you know. And
so there's all these like
animal allegories, and it's a fun book. I'm really enjoying it. It has the potential to be super dark, but I think they've twisted it in such a way that it always ends up being a little bit lighter, just to round things off, so you're not constantly going to this pit of awfulness. So that's been good. But really, the book that I was super happy to read and I could not stop laughing after reading was Jughead number 5. And I think this is the dumbest, funniest comic I've read in a very long time, quite honestly. It is... They take the classic trope of when a gang of teens go to another city and they meet their gender swapped versions of themselves. So Jughead meets a lady Jughead, and Archie meets a lady Archie, and Betty meets a male version of herself, and Reggie meets Regina, and they end up making out. And if you don't know any of the Archie cast, like, maybe that doesn't make sense, but oh my goodness, gross. I could not stop laughing at this stupid, stupid, overly done joke, just done in the best and most cliched tropey way ever. And they just Chip Zdarsky absolutely owned it, and I cannot recommend this book enough. This is the funniest comic book I've read in a very long time. It's specifically this issue. Even if you, I think if you just picked up this issue, there's a little bit of context, but otherwise you could probably read this and just have a good time. So I really love this book. If I don't know, the Archie books are kicking ass for some reason right now for me.
I didn't know Zdarsky was on it.
Yeah, Chip Zdarsky's writing it, and what's her name? I feel so awful. Is drawing it. She has the same art style as the person that's on Squirrel Girl, whose name is escaping me as well. But it's a lot of fun. So Nick, what'd you read this week?
For me, I'll breeze through some of the smaller items first, out of concern and due deference to the headliner here. I read Constantine 8 and Dr. Fate 8. Those who have been keeping up on these books, which I'm roughly estimating probably about 6 other people read Constantine, and I'm probably the only person reading Dr. Fate. true to DC form, their books do tend to get better the moment that their imminent cancellation has already been announced. And I mm-hmm. can unfortunately conclude that with both of these books, yeah, they're actually, I think Dr. Fate finally turned the corner, which is real great, because he's got about 3 more issues to go before DC Rebirth, quite ironically, kills him.
Are they letting them finish out the arc?
Yes, they're letting them finish out the arc, although that's not always generosity. That's just the fact that DC says, well, shit, we're on issue 8, we put 1 through 6 in the first trade paperback, we need to pump out a few more issues so that we can actually ship a trade number 2.
It's a mercy. They're mercy killing this story.
Yeah. It's a mercy killing you profit off of. Yeah, exactly. So I read those. I read the Bloodshot Annual, which I'm disturbed to say I actually have 3 copies of now, just because covers are pretty and I am stupid. That being said, it's also a $6 issue, so I'm extra stupid.
Nick doesn't understand money.
I have one of those copies at my house.
I just throw these green pieces of paper at people and sometimes I get metal back and I don't really fully comprehend exactly what's going on. Let's just be honest. But that was really interesting. Jeff Lemire in Kano, which is the abbreviation for Jose Angel Cano Lopez. He has a really cool abbreviation for his name, all caps. I'm gonna try to do the same with my name at some point, maybe. Told sort of what seemed like a really funny Bloodshot versus Jason. If you forget Jason, he's the one who tells you you're not supposed to be banging at summer camp or he'll kill you. Yeah. But then, of course, it's Jeff Lemire, so it turns into a weird, I feel bad for the bad guy sort of story. And Ray Fox, interestingly, has another story that actually builds upon the Lemire story if you really pay attention and figure out where they interconnect. But it's Ray Fox, which means, no offense, sometimes you look at the art and you have to stare for a while to figure out exactly what you're looking at. That doesn't make it any less pretty, but it does make it a little confusing. Red Army of Darkness, Furious Road, which, yes, is Army of Darkness meets Mad Max. There's no bones about it.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's fun. And for Army of Darkness, once you've read a couple Army of Darkness comics, you kind of go, okay, these sort of have a this happens structure. And they've kind of flipped it on its head a bit. I don't want to give too much away, but Ash does not show up until very far into the first issue, which is probably going to dissuade some people. But fuck them.
Interesting.
And finally, Batman 50. Wow, so much to say. So much to say. I read it last night. God damn it. Scott Snyder just perfectly nail right on the head ending. Just, it's one of those things where, like, I think he honestly set up the way to end this book all the way back in, like, the second issue of Endgame and just punctuates it perfectly. He's like, remember when I talked about this in the first one, and here it is, pitch perfect ending. Interesting because, and maybe not surprising because Rebirth is around the corner, Snyder pays a lot more attention to basically tying up all of the loose ends instead of maybe trying to lightly set up what will happen next. There's almost nothing in the way of, well, this guy's probably going to do this next. This guy's probably going to be this next. It's much more about providing a sense of closure to the run. It was a massively oversized $6 issue. All of my books are now $6. What is happening? Help.
So with the wrap up of all of the various storylines and characters or whatever, did it feel forced by any means? I mean, I understand that you're saying this, it seems perfect, but did it feel like, okay, well, we need to, you know, tie up these loose ends that we kind of forgot about or in things like that? I mean, some artists or some creators will do that,
right? Or the idea that maybe I would have liked some things to sort of leave on a, well, I wonder where this is going to go or whatnot note. It didn't really seem forced. I think it helped that this issue was massively oversized. And if you remember, Yannick Paquette drew 49, and the main reason was to give Capullo a lot more time to finish out this huge issue, which felt like it had all of the time it needed to do what it did. In fact, Paquette actually draws the epilogue in this issue, interestingly enough.
Oh, cool.
As well. So it was a really well thought out, nice, oversized issue with no compromising. Capullo got to draw all of the main part. No extra inkers, no extra colorists. They took extra time with it, and I really appreciate it. And I hope DC notices just how well they did this, and I hope they pay attention. They won't. And delivered this sort of very conscious, this is what people want, this is a quality product in the future. And that being said, Rebirth is double booking, so fuck it, it's not going to happen.
So just to throw this out there, because you were talking about maybe that they had it planned or not, last year at C2E2, I went to a whole bunch of panels with Scott Snyder, and that was one of the questions someone asked, like, how far ahead have you plotted this? And he said when he went on it, like, from the get-go, he plotted out, okay, this is what it'll do be if I have the as much time as I want. And that was the right ending we're getting. And then he also planned in jumping off points in case it got canceled, which is, yeah, some of the other arcs could have been transformed into endings for the series kind of thing, but this is the ultimate where he, and so by last year he knew he was going to be able to do the full thing, and he was like, yep, this is exactly where we've been going this whole time, and it was like plotted out years ago.
Cool.
Kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I think at one point someone on Twitter asked, and he said normally he's thinking two arcs ahead at least. And I remember someone asked, like, genuinely, what was the, like, original, like, for a while, what was the original end point? And I think Endgame was actually supposed to be the end. I mean, well, it's called Endgame, Nick. You're so fucking stupid. Yeah, okay. Got it. The three or four people who listen who get overly agitated. Yes, I realize it's called Endgame. How clever. I should have figured it out. And that's why it's so interesting that you have Endgame, which was supposed to be the end, and then Snyder went, well, okay, I've got more time, and then he's like, I'm going to flip this thing on its, you know, wow, yeah, Nick, keep swearing. Jeez, what's your problem? I'm just going to flip this thing on its head and go super heavy. And, of course, super heavy was, hey, what if Bruce isn't Batman? What if Commissioner Gordon's Batman? What if we have this really weird Batman suit? And it's like Scott Snyder going, well, guess what? I wasn't even supposed to be able to do this, so I'm just going to really go nuts, which was great. Anyway, it's Batman. I've probably gone over.
I've become so big that no one can at DC can say no to me. So, hold on.
Yeah,
so
he's the one who forced them to.
Yeah. I thought that all of these big name titles were going to 52 issues. Like, that was the big thing.
Yeah.
I think, oh God, this has gotten, I've heard so many different things on this, and I'm sure someone's going to correct me, but I think there's actually going to be a 51 for some books, and then after that you're going to get a one shot which is going to be called Rebirth : whatever the book is called, but obviously only books that are going into Rebirth will get those. So like Batman will get a Rebirth : Batman issue, and then it'll be Batman number one again.
Okay. Well, this kind of segues really well into what we're going to talk about today.
Which we'll get to, but before we get there, what are the two of you excited for this week? Nick, I'll just turn right back to you.
Sure, absolutely. And I can keep this relatively brief, famous last words. So I'm really excited for Predator Life and Death. Is it Predator Life and Death? Predator Life or Death? I mix this up all the time, and I even wrote it down so this wouldn't happen, and guess what? It's Predator Life and Death. Number two, I'm really excited for this book, even though Predator is kind of one of those things that almost has a forced trajectory that goes something like this. Hi, we're Marines. We're going to a planet. We have a mission. Also, there's this guy working for Weyland-Yutani, which is an evil corporation with us. Also, he has a secret mission. Also, we're going to get there and things are going to try to kill us because he has a secret ulterior motive. Oh shit, if this happens so much, why does it keep happening? That being said, I will read that over and over again because it's hilarious, because the Predator basically plays a game of hide and seek and just, you know, teleports, and not really teleports, but, you know, cloaks himself and then just kills people in terrible ways most of the time, like removing their head and their spinal cord and just ripping it off and then holding it in the air like, hey guys, what's up? Because Predators are dreadlocked dude bros from their whatever planet that just basically kidnap humans and other people, but largely humans, and then set traps, and it's really not a fair fight, and just kill them in awful ways. And and I love it, and I can't wait.
So these are just like violent fantasy enactments kind of things. Okay.
Are you inquiring about my subconscious or something?
Right? No, I think we understand. Your dude bro subconscious wants to kill people.
I'm going to have some natty ice when this podcast is done. I'm going to go grab some natty ice and some Doritos. That being said, and I do want to give full credit here, I think that this new series by Dan Abnett has really towed the line between reinforcing the expectations of what a Predator series will do in terms of the violence, in terms of the sci-fi, in terms of the Aliens franchise in general, while also subverting a lot of the norms, just subtly in little ways that are, the characters are much more nuanced than normal, I would say, at the very least, but yeah, I would definitely encourage people to get on board with this. It's a fun event. I like it a lot.
Nice.
Cool. Kate, what are you excited for this week? I know what you're excited for because you and I picked the same book, actually.
It's true.
You can start.
I mean, I was going to do Vision number 6, but then I'm like, every time I'm on the show, I talk about Vision. So just throwing that out there, though, that this is the last issue in this arc of Vision, so it's pretty exciting. But I'm excited for Black Widow number 2. I was really late to this party. I didn't get on board until multiple weeks of listening to you, Mike, and Tia and Paul gushing about the brilliance of this book. And I was like, oh, okay. So I got it in digital and it is crazy awesome. So this is the Sam Nee Wade Wilson book, but the solicits say that it's just Sam Nee on writing and art. So I don't know if that's...
Yeah.
Nick and I had a little discussion about how covers... cover credits work sometimes and sometimes are not as accurate as you'd like them to be. So anyway, I'm excited for this. This is just like one of those books you read in like 2 minutes flat because it's all action, but then you have to read it like five more times because it's so much fun.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I don't know where this book is going because number one was such just a fly through. Like you said, you could read it in 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the direction, like, and that's the perfect hook, I think, for a movie. It's a classic action scene opening where you're being pushed because there's nothing else for you to do than keep going. Like, there's no studying of the art, there's no studying of the dialogue because there was almost no dialogue in the book, and
which is ballsy as hell.
Awesome. But it was so cool because it was a chase scene, mm-hmm. and it's the opening 2 minutes of an action TV show or the opening 10 minutes of an action movie, and that's always the best. Like, you know, it sets the tone, hopefully, for the rest of the series where this is going to be fast paced. This is going to be, you know, something's on the line and Black Widow has to figure this out. And I'm so excited for this book. And especially after rereading all of the old Daredevil stuff that was on sale a couple mm-hmm. weeks back. And I'm loving this team. Like, Chris Samnee and Mark Waid are fantastic. And I can't express how excited I am for this book. It's Black Widow and I love her, and it's Mark Waid and Chris Samnee and I love them. Like, there is nothing wrong with this book, and anyone who says otherwise, shoot me an email. I want to talk to you about this because I think you're wrong.
Talk to you / fight you.
That's right. Come talk to me where I lecture you about your terrible tastes. Well, the reason I was so late to the party is because I was so in love with the last Black Widow run.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, this looks different. I don't know. But it's totally worth it. So,
yeah.
I think Samnee was a really good choice for that book because, and this isn't a knock against his art, this is a positive in my mind. Sometimes there are artists whose art, as you were saying, Mike, kind of force you to slow down and focus and be like, well, this is very detailed. I better pay really close attention to what's going on,
mm-hmm.
aka I have a problem with him, but Alex Ross. But with Samnee's art, it's not hyper detailed. It's great, but it's not hyper detailed, so you can really quickly pick up on all of the things, you know, grab all of the elements
exactly.
visually and just flow through them. It's a really easy style to like look at and just blaze through everything. And that's a good thing in this case.
Well, and they've done the really standard setup of, like Mike was talking about, of the way you set up action sequences so much, where you do the climax first and then you go back in like 24 hours previous kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm wondering if that's what's going to be
this
book,
then,
kind of
yeah.
thing. Yeah, that's how you get people interested in the story, is you give them essentially the conclusion or climax first and then backtrack to how you got there. You see it on TV all the time.
What is the very, very minimalist, like, premise that you guys have surmised here? She's on the run, right?
Yeah,
and S.H.I.E.L.D. wants her ass.
Something, whether it's a device or info or something, I don't remember. Or maybe we don't know. But she is busting out of S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters when we first see her. And they are announcing over the speakers that she is now an enemy of S.H.I.E.L.D. and get her kind of thing. And of course, they don't get her because that would end the series pretty quickly.
Yeah. One shot. It's a one shot, guys.
Right. So she has something. And basically now she's alienated from S.H.I.E.L.D. and has to, we don't know, do something.
Sounds like Cap 2, which is a good thing.
Yeah, well... this is what makes a good number one. There's so many questions, and yet you're still so like driven to want to continue reading. You don't have questions that say, what was this actually about? Instead, it's what's going to happen next. And it's the right balance of mystery and action and good storytelling,
enough.
As far as I'm concerned.
Like you were talking about Uncanny X-Men, and when I read the first of that, I was so lost that I'm like, yeah, that doesn't make me want to read the next one, and I never did.
Yeah.
So
I know.
Just sort of the difference between having good questions to ask about something and having bad questions to ask about something.
Yeah, you need at least some info there.
Yeah. So, yeah, ultimately, if you're not reading Black Widow, you do yourself a favor and buy number one. It's
absolutely,
it's such a good read.
Hey guys, so we're back here talking about comic book marketing and distribution and the feelings, strong feelings we have about some of the stuff that's going on right now with the summer events and pricing restructuring and shipping restructuring. And so before we jump in and give Nick the reins to vent his feelings about DC Rebirth here.
Again, we're gonna, like the fourth week in a row.
Oh, he's got so many, though. This is like his weekly therapy session where he just comes and talks about it, works through his issues.
I'm actually laying on the couch right now.
So we've talked a lot on the show before about marketing, quote unquote, but we're really only getting at one facet of it. Marketing is, we talk about the four P's of marketing. It's your product, your placement, the price, and the promotion. And usually when people talk about marketing, they're thinking about just the promotion aspect, you know, your advertising, your public relations, that kind of stuff, which, side note, I went to school for, so hey, Marvel DC, wink, wink, looking for a job, but...
Or Valiant, or Boom, or
that's
Oni,
right,
you
Image
know.
Would be dream come true, but anyway, moving on. So we're actually going to talk more this episode about the other three aspects of it, the product itself, the placement of where they're selling stuff, because this has gotten really interesting with, you know, releasing first on digital and then going to print and doing odd things with, you know, exclusive here before that's on sale at another shop and so on and so forth, and changings of pricing structures. So the obvious one to jump into here is DC's Rebirth event. They're reducing the price down to $2.99. Which is when you're thinking, you know, oh, it's only a dollar less, but that's actually, they're getting like a third, fourth less money for each issue. Mm-hmm. They're then going to double ship it, which can only mean that they're doing smaller issues. If you're shipping it twice as often and charging so much less, Nick and I were talking about this last night, they're going to have to be smaller issues, which then means you've got to think about what are you doing to your product then. DC was already having some quality issues in that regard, and it doesn't matter how well you promote stuff if the actual product, you know, one of my professors used to make a joke about how you can, no matter how good your ads are, you can only sell crap once, and once the buyers bought it that one time, they're not going to pick it up again. So you can package it all you want, but so what's going to happen with this? And they're also doing, because of this double shipping, they're going to have multiple art teams on books. And then, so they have two listed and then a rotating on-call art team, like just in case something happens.
Yeah. What does that even mean though?
Right. So it's like, they're just, obviously this has gotten a lot of press. And so the promotion aspect has been solid. They're tying it in really well to their movies and they're doing all the right things that, you know, textbook definition of what you're supposed to do to kind of dribble out the information where first you announce the titles and then you announce the creative team for this. And this basically, so you're just keeping it in the news and they've been rocking that. But then the other aspects of it, you're just, I don't know. I think this might be one of those things where you can only sell it once. But what do you think, Nick?
And then 60 minutes went by.
Right?
And then someone else was allowed to
talk. I just imagine you back on your couch, leaning back, like, okay.
Yeah. I'm just now in a straitjacket for those wondering. Well, I think it does bear mention, and I'm not always going to go to bat for DC. I think it does need to be put forward that... much like my parents used to say to me when it was time to get grounded, you know, I'm only doing this because I love you. I think those were the words. DC, I'm only doing this because I love you or because I've convinced myself that anything otherwise would be, you know, psychologically damaging. It is worth pointing out that not all of the books are double shipping.
Oh, okay.
Which is a little bit in their defense. However, I do believe the majority will be double shipping.
Is it just their really big name titles?
Books. Yeah.
It's the bigger ones, okay. Yes. Relatively speaking, higher profile titles, higher profile characters, those will be the ones double shipping. But as you were pointing out, one of the bigger issues is that Sure. Some of these books were already at $3. That's true. Or $2.99 or whatever you want to do with that damn penny. So for example, Constantine the Hellblazer was already at $2.99. It's going to stay at $2.99.
Yeah, it's their bigger books book that like are going that. Down.
Right, exactly. So Constantine, yes, you're paying the same, so you're not getting a price discount. You're just being forced to buy it more every month, which, depending upon how you feel, still not great. If you're talking about something like Batman, however, yes, the price is going to drop from $4 to $3, and unless they're going to be really, really, really generous, the page count is going to drop. I think normal comics were somewhere around, I'm sure someone knows this exactly, I think quote-unquote smaller $2.99 comics were somewhere closer to 26 pages, 28 pages, and the $4 comics were closer to 32. So everything's going to get smashed down to $2.99. Are the pages going to be uniform in count for all the books as well? I don't see how they wouldn't be. And yeah, you're right. In terms of product concerns, that brings up a lot of questions, especially about how some of these books are going to run. Do I want a Batman with less pages and no B story or no ability to really tell a longer story? Not really. Do I want Justice League with a smaller page count? No, but I read that in trade, so maybe some of the concerns there are allayed.
And DC should just cater a lot of what they're doing to Dick, so...
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, they clearly have in the past.
He is the thing that matters.
Yeah, yeah.
But in all seriousness, DC, well, where Marvel and Image have worked really hard to court new readers and more diverse audiences, like they have come to realize that females also have money, DC has really decided to just buckle down on the old guard, and Nick fits that demographic pretty exactly. I mean, you're the, you know, 30-something male that's been reading comics forever, so As much as the joke is, oh, they should cater to Nick, that is exactly what they're trying to do. So,
well, let's set the record straight here on a few points.
Okay, correct me.
I am not 30 yet.
Oh, sorry.
I am close, and I've only really been reading comics, and I know everyone's going to be like, gasp, I knew it, he's a fake.
Go for it.
For probably about 6 or 7 years.
That's a significant amount of time, though.
That's still a significant. I mean, the problem is when you're like me and you end up hanging around certain other people, or you're hanging around at your shop, or you know people that have been there forever, like 6 or 7 years is like, wow, like, what have you read? Like 6 books ever?
Well, see,
like, you must know nothing. But really, that's just the whole culture of, you know, you must be this smart to enter
exactly.
comics, which is like
you must have read all 50 of the
minute
things.
Discussion.
I think that's an old style of thinking, because I honestly think that someone who's read comics for 6 months can be just as insightful as someone who's read comics for 30 years. And quite honestly, the person that's read for 30 years is probably very, very stuck in their ways. I don't know. That's
right.
That's a whole different discussion for today than what we're trying to talk about today.
So with marketing stuff, when you're looking at different demographics, there's some set ones that are just, you know, across all product line, you know, different industries that you talk about, and it's how you kind of buy and sell ad space and stuff like Google AdWords and stuff. There's these really set demographics, right? And the one that DC seems to be going after hard is that sweet, sweet 18 to 25 male demographic, which when you can get them are a gold mine, because y'all don't have the best inhibitions financially. And that tends to be where you get the high spending before then people go, where they have disposable income before they're locked into saving for a house or, you know, supporting a family. So that definitely seems to be what they're going after. But at the same time, it's like, look around you, DC. The, you know, Marvel and Image have just been killing it by not doing that. And maybe they feel edged out of that those other demographics. And so they're just trying to lock into this one, but it's hard to say. The other thing with this double shipping is a large part of that, at least according to some of the articles I've read, seems to be trying to court shops, where a lot of shops, comic shops, were not ordering so much DC anymore because they were just getting stuck with it. And they were paying these high prices, and it wasn't generating foot traffic, and it wasn't generating sales. And so they've restructured So part of the double shipping was to court vendors to bring it onto their shelves, because that generates more foot traffic. If you're coming in, you know, twice a month to pick up your book instead of once, the idea is that while you're at the shop, you'll see other things, you'll buy more stuff. And then the other thing they're doing is doing much more forgiving. Like you can, they'll buy back books for like the first arc or something. So you're not so stuck with it.
I think the first six issues are going to be returnable the first 3 months, and that's generous.
Well, for shops, absolutely. Especially when you're talking, like, obviously someone like Midtown Comics can take a bigger leeway of taking risks. But when you're talking about little shops like the shop I go to in Kalamazoo, like if they get stuck with a certain number of books in a few months, that would really damage them financially.
Right.
So it's a big deal for getting that book onto the shelf in the first place. They have also jumped on board with what some other publishers have been doing, where they're having it on sale in shops before it's on sale online, like on Amazon, which is another way to court these retailers to get it on the physical shelves.
Are you talking like collected editions?
Yeah, where you can buy the trades like a month earlier or a few weeks earlier in shop than you can on Amazon.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, and some other publishers have been doing that too, as a way to try and get shops to order the books. And you want to feel like it's a friendly thing, like trying to support local shops, but in reality, what they're doing is just trying to get their book more out there. But yeah, it's a thing. I don't know. We'll see how it works. Like I said, like if it's, I feel like they are really focusing on their price and placement and promotion, but it seems like they're doing it at the sacrifice of the product itself. So we'll see if what happens here, because really, if you don't have the product to begin with, you're not going to sell very many after those first or second issues.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about a lot of the creative teams, but I think a lot of the, you'll also notice that a lot of the titles, and we talked about this right when Rebirth came out, or when they announced Rebirth, but Marvel's doing this exact same thing, where they're tying a lot of their big pushes and their big number ones to movie release dates.
Absolutely.
So that when, you know, when a movie comes out, you'll also say, oh, look, we can also go to the comic book shop and pick up the number one, or vice versa. You know, yeah. Oh, I can read Suicide Squad number one right before the movie comes out that Friday. And that's, I think that's perfect timing. That's a great way to try to get new readers, or get readers that are, you know, maybe just interested in the movies into comics. I mean, we've talked about how that conversion rate is very, very small and pretty much impossible. But nonetheless, it's definitely going to drive more sales for people that are already reading comics. If they just saw the movie and they weren't necessarily interested in Suicide Squad, maybe they'd be more willing to pick up that number one.
Absolutely. And especially for publishers that don't own the movie rights, it is just totally free advertising for them that they might as well jump on board with, like the X-Men movie. They're not paying for those ads, but there's massive hype for X-Men right now, so you might as well put out all the X books and all the Apocalypse books, because why not take advantage of free advertising?
Yeah, the big X-Men crossover, that's not really a crossover, and it's more just an event where they're putting the title of Apocalypse Wars on Uncanny X-Men, Extraordinary X-Men, and All New X-Men, and the books aren't actually crossing over, but they take place in the same theme, dealing with Apocalypse in some way, shape, or form.
We're splitting so many hairs here.
I know. But it's very important, because, you know, to let me just get on my little bit of X-Men soapbox, as I do pretty much every week, you know.
It's not a small one.
This is, this is a weird thing. Marvel's been doing this they do this almost every summer, where there's an X-Men event of some sort, and whether it's a crossover book where you have to read Uncanny followed by Extraordinary followed by All New X-Men in order to get the full story, or they just have this banner at the top that says event title, and they just have the books take place within the same, you know, I guess, event of itself, like something's happening, but they're not, the various books aren't actually overlapping in story. That's like two different things. They did that with all Avengers versus X-Men. They did that with, but they did the exact opposite with Battle of the Atom, where Battle of the Atom, you had to read the four X-Men books in a row in order to get the full story, and you had to read them in a specific order, or the story wouldn't make any sense.
That.
Yeah, and that's when I trade weight it, because I just can't handle
yeah,
it.
Yeah, as a monthly reader, it's somewhat frustrating. But then again, I'm a sucker, as I always say, and I'm reading all these X-Men books in the first place, so it doesn't affect me. But I feel like if you are a person who's just enjoying, you know, all new X-Men, or just enjoying Extraordinary X-Men, and or I can't understand you, but you just enjoy Uncanny X-Men, you know, these types of things where you have to read one after the other to get the story is really annoying. But having them just under this umbrella of Apocalypse Wars, it's not that big of a deal. You know that the Apocalypse War story is coming because they do a very, very, very obvious job of bringing that some aspect of Apocalypse into the story early on in the book, and you know that it's coming. I don't know.
Yeah.
At least they've done that in all three X-Men books right now.
I don't know what the technical term is for in comics, but I know in fiction, in the fiction publishing industry, you call those parallel novels, where they're set in the same time span with the same events, but you're following different characters with different storylines.
Yeah, I mean, that's all of Marvel and DC, though.
Yeah. Well, but to more or less of an extent. Like, there's definitely, I don't know. They're like, if they're fighting the same baddie, yeah. Like...
There are those books that do that, and then there are the ones that I read that aren't interested in playing along with anything else and die.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yes.
Okay, so Nick, you might know this. For Rebirth, have they only announced a whole bunch of ongoings? Because that's another thing that Marvel and Image have had wild success with, is having a lot of not ongoing series. Mini and maxi series
things.
Have been, people have just been all over that. And has DC announced any of that, or is it just all ongoing?
I'm trying to remember. I want to say there's very little focus on miniseries. I think there was some speculation about maybe another Poison Ivy miniseries, given the success of the current one. But nothing is really coming.
So all the big stuff they've announced are ongoings then.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, it's not a massive coincidence that if you look at the characters that are featured in the Batman v Superman movie,
right.
If you look at the characters in the Suicide Squad movie, and you look at what is coming out of Rebirth, there is very little that does not overlap between the two.
Yeah.
Go figure. Now, you can say they're trying to plan according to the movie, but I think also that just has a lot to do with the fact that they've said these are 12 characters that have always made money, that we have rarely ever had to cancel the books of, that generally will make money hand over fist. End of story.
Yep.
We're not going to experiment with anything anymore. And that's a bit of a blanket statement. But
well, and when you have these movies comes out, you have a flood of other products that you usually don't really think about when you're a comic fan, but there are considered products of the line, like your T-shirts and your lunch boxes and your figurines.
Action
and
figures.
Yeah, and
do they actually release those stuff just about around events, though?
Or is it just like I'm talking the movies.
Oh, well, I mean, okay, yeah, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, so, like... That stuff's all sitting in your shelves when you go on into Target and Toys R Us and stuff, and so it becomes like a constant reinforcement, if you will. Like, people are just seeing it around and seeing it around, and so not having a book out to go with it would be foolish, you know? It would just be wasted opportunity there.
And I think a lot of the reason, and I've sort of touched on this a little bit in the past, and again, I'm not going to totally go to bat for DC on this, but I think a lot of the reason that you're seeing this desperation now is that everyone's like, well, you know, why is Marvel able to take chances now? Why is Marvel getting really creative and really putting out some interesting stuff? And sure, I think a lot of it is that they are courting a more diverse reader base that is responding to such. But I think another side of it is the fact that with Star Wars making money hand over fist, go look at
they
the top selling
cushion.
Comics of last year. It will blow your mind.
Yep. They have a huge
cushion. With that make. Yeah, exactly.
It was like they when T and I were talking about Walking Dead, and we're like, yeah, well, even if we don't love it, it's. Gives Image such an enormous cushion to do what they want with other titles that, you're not wrong.
I honestly think, and this is just maybe a bit hyperbolic, but right now Marvel could probably shut down the superhero side of things, go strictly Star Wars, and still beat the pants off of probably every other publisher right now, sales-wise. Maybe.
You hear it, heard it here first, kids. Okay.
Nick White loves Marvel, doesn't read any of it.
Yeah.
Nick White hates DC, still buying too much.
Well, speaking of Marvel, they're doing their big Civil War II event this summer,
Didn't Mark Millar even say he was not interested in the idea of a Civil War II?
Well, Bendis is writing it.
Oh,
and so I did not want to be on board with this, but a bunch of the books I read are like tie in, and so
of course
it's like you're gonna read it whether you want to or not.
They've got
to
pick a side, just like
this
you
is
do,
like
Kate.
This is a big event. It's Brian Michael Bendis writing, and who's doing art for that?
Oh, I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
That is a good question.
They've already you can already pre-order the hardcover of this event on Amazon for November, which I think is just insane.
Yeah, I
David Marquez is the artist.
Thank you.
For those
you beat
wondering.
Me to it. Okay.
I was.
What does that name mean?
We,
what does
we
that name mean to anybody?
To
I don't know this guy. Yeah. Everyone's like, I'm going to be the hero here. No one else is doing it.
It's such a bizarre thing because I can't understand. I mean, if, I'm not reading enough Avengers. I'm not reading enough in universe like stories that aren't X-Men to maybe know what the state of things are in the Marvel universe, but. At the same time, I can't even imagine what would spark this off. Like, we just had the big Inhumans event. We just had the big AVX event. Like,
I have
Secret
the
Wars.
Answer you seek, Mike. Okay, so the premise is that there's a new Inhuman, because remember, we keep getting tons and tons more Inhumans because of the...
Yeah.
So there's a new one that has just hatched or what have you, and her power is that she can see the future, and so she's kind of like a prophet, and the...
Lame.
It's what do you do with this information, and different factions have different ideas of how they want to bend and shape the future or not, and that is what the struggle is about.
Okay.
Mini premise.
Pushing real hard on those Inhumans, Marvel.
They really are. They're like, we don't own the X-Men, but that doesn't matter because Inhumans.
But still, the fact remains that this is happily lining up with the release of Captain America Civil War.
Absolutely.
But in traditional comics fashion, the comic book story has absolutely nothing to do with the movie, to the point where I think if someone jumped into this new Civil War after going to see Captain America and being super excited, oh, look, a new Civil War book, and I just saw Captain America, they would be absolutely lost.
Well, throw that in there. If they just went and reread, like, they just... I think this Wednesday is when it comes out, the new special edition hardcover of the original Civil War event. But even if you saw the movie and then went and read that, it wouldn't make much sense because they had to change so much because it didn't fit for the MCU. Like, the whole premise of revealing secret identities doesn't work in the MCU where everyone knows who everyone is. So,
well, and I don't think it's the necessary. I don't think it's necessarily like about secret identities. If we're going to talk about the Civil War thing, I think it is about registration, and that's the key story. Like. Point is that, you know, should these people be reined in by a government oversight, or should they be, you know, independent working vigilantes? And that's
right.
That's ultimately what this is what's happening in the story with Captain America Civil War. But I think Cap's motivation in the movie doesn't make as much sense given how uber patriotic he's been in the last two movies and in the Avengers movies. So they're gonna have to make a real hard character twist at the beginning of Civil War in order to make that story make sense in the movie. So I'm real curious to see how they do that.
Oh, Civil War.
Well, jeez. So the other big summer thing we were gonna talk about was the Valiants 4001 AD, which is a whole lot smaller than the other events. I mean, if you look at Marvel's Civil War II solicits, there are like 4 or 5 different miniseries coming out of it, and it ties into all these ongoings, and it, you know, it's this huge, where Valiants is much smaller. And take it away, Nick.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Nick. Get another, 10 minutes in on this.
Give me 1 second. I need to open this gratuity check from Valiant over here. So Valiant has always had this mentality, and who knows, I say this now, and maybe in like 10 years it'll be this towering behemoth, and I'll be like, remember when this wasn't the case? But they've always sort of had a quality over quantity idea, and they've always attempted to try to keep an even keel on how many books they have out at any given point in time. Books don't generally show up unless other books are being shuttered. That's just how things are. And for this year, the event is going to be 4001 AD, as Kate said, and this one is attempting to finally inject a little bit of life into the whatever you want to call it, the future Valiant verse. I don't have a good name for it yet.
Well, it's the 4001 verse, right? Isn't that what they're calling it?
Or the 4001 verse.
Yeah, yeah, it's...
yeah, I think that's the name they're using, which I don't... I'm going to come up with a better one, guys. Just give me a second. And article writers, hold on. I coined Valiant verse. Don't let anyone else tell you otherwise. I thought of it, and I knew no one else had thought of it. I'm confident. Trademarked. But, so you've got the 4001 universe, and back in the 90s, small history lesson, the Valiant universe was kind of split into two groups. You had the quote-unquote modern day, and you had the future Valiant universe. And both were kind of well occupied because someone such as Eternal Warrior, who was immortal, he found his way into 4001 amongst other characters, specifically Rai being the main one. And in the past couple years since Valiant rebooted, really the 4001 universe has just been Rai. There was one fun cameo appearance by Ivar Timewalker because, right, it's called Ivar Timewalker, so what do you want to happen? So he shows up for a split second in one of his books, but beyond that, unless you read really between the lines of Eternal Warrior, and that's a whole nother story, it's just been Rai.
Yeah.
So they're going to try to put some life into it, and they've done that just through a couple pretty clever PR campaigns. If you read the previews catalog last month, they had a really nice sort of postcard-sized, really hard stock piece of paper that basically was a mini little checklist for the event. And you couldn't miss it, because if you were trying to go to anything else in the damn catalog last month, you just naturally flipped open this. It was unavoidable. And if I didn't love Valiant, or you don't love Valiant, it probably thoroughly pissed you off. But what works for Valiant, I think, quite a bit in terms of marketing and presentation, is that there is not a huge buy-in to their events. There's just not a lot. Last year, when we had Book of Death, which was a huge event, in fact, they even went to go so far as it's quote-unquote the biggest-selling independent crossover event of the decade. So there's about five qualifiers in there. Mm-hmm. I think they said the last one before it was Dynamite's Masks, which I don't really remember that.
Yeah, maybe I don't remember that. I remember that being a big deal in the previews book and then seeing nothing after that.
Right. But it was a big deal for Valiant, oddly enough. They said that it was going to be their ideal jumping on point, which was weird because they did the Valiant months before and that was a better choice, but whatever, I'm not in charge. And it sold over 200,000 books altogether. And that only consisted of 8 issues, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
There was a very small buy-in. Every month, there was one book for the miniseries, Book of Death, 1, 2, 3, 4, and every month there was a quote-unquote called a fall of issue, and it showed you into the far-flung future where some of these characters met their end. So there was a fall of Ninjak, there was a fall of Exo Man of War, a fall of Bloodshot, and
so... They're just culling their heroes.
Right, exactly. Well, a potential culling of heroes, what could happen, what might happen. Okay. But it allowed them to tell some really far out, really interesting stories that didn't exactly have to have repercussions. But what I liked the most is you could buy in at a very low price and not feel like you were getting screwed over. Like Civil War 2, where it's like...
If you
like
bought all in, you'd be like getting 9 books a month, yeah.
Oh, if not more, yeah. Exactly.
How many total a month is the Valiant event this summer?
So this time around, it's going to be a little bit more if you want to 100% commit. Every month is going to be the miniseries issue. So 4001 AD, 1, 2, 3, 4. There's going to be an issue of Rai, the ongoing Rai series, which is also going to play into it. And then there's going to be a one-shot issue, each of which is going to focus, again, much like the Fall of series, is going to focus on a different character. So all in all, that's $12 a month to get everything. So
you're only getting 3 books a month to do the whole thing. That is, so they're doing like the literal opposite approach of DC, where DC is just like flooding the market with their stuff, and Valiant's like, no, quality versus quantity.
Well, yeah. No, I think once... you as a reader have been through a big two event, and a big one. So I'm talking like if you were reading DC's Trinity War, and you were reading the main alongside the Trinity War Blight books, mm-hmm. or if you were reading, I think Original Sin kind of got way out of hand as well. I mean, Mike, you can correct me on that, but that had a lot of stuff. The moment you read an event like that and you don't 100% commit, because most of us are human and or have a loose idea of what happens when you... exactly. Or you have a small idea of how money works and what happens when you don't have it. When you deal with an event like that, and maybe even if you only make it to read half of it, you start getting this weird anxiety feeling of like, what am I missing out?
Exactly.
Or the moment you get slightly confused, you're like, is this because the book is bad, or is this because I didn't commit because I'm a bad person?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's like you feel like you're a bad person so much as you feel like I should have gone all in on this. And
exactly,
it's like a you
it's
feel,
on me.
It's on. Well, it's like I always feel torn in that. Like I tried to read Original Sin and I read the the main series, and I was like, I don't really care about half of the other books, so why would I read them? And yet those story points in those books felt like they tied in. Or if you I think if you were only reading one of the side books and you weren't reading the main event, like you would just get lost. I don't know. It's a bummer because that's a huge financial investment, especially when it comes to Marvel and DC, to say like, oh, you have to read 40 of our books in order to get this whole story. And that's ridiculous. And I always praise Civil War for being so fantastic, but if you look back and you see how many issues are actually tied into Civil War, I want to say it's upwards of like 70, maybe more.
Oh, and there's entire Civil War series that are separate, like Civil War X-Men and Civil War House of M. And
yeah, they tied into every single ongoing book. There was no book that was left untouched at that time. And like that seems really cool from like a collector's perspective. You know, if you were to say, okay, I'm going to buy this over the next 5 years, like looking back, collecting all those books would be super cool. But at the time, buying like 8 books guaranteed a month on top of your other publisher books.
Right.
Like that's insane. Or maybe that's 8 books a week.
But see, they keep doing it, so it must work.
I
mean, like obviously the attempt is to get you to buy more books that you're not already buying, like other ongoings and so on and so forth. So since they keep doing it, man, it must work. I don't know the numbers, but
we say this. I've said this
as much as we complain.
Again,
like,
you know, if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it.
Exactly.
You know? But
in fact, Nick White, do you actually have some educational information? Yes, I do. Will it be boring? Probably.
Hit us.
But just point of reference, okay? So how well do these events do? So Secret Wars last year began in May, so it's your classic summer big event, right? So eight of the 9 issues came out during 2015. Of the top-selling issues of last year, these were the rankings of the issues, and they were in order. So number 1 did sell the most, number 2 did sell the second most, unsurprisingly. That's just, you know, people start and then they drop off. Here were the rankings of, like, out of the top 1,000 issues where Secret Wars fell in. They were number 2, 13, 14, 15, 19, 23, 25, and 27. And that's even more impressive because the books ranked 1, 3, and 4 were Loot Crate boosted.
Wow.
And of course, number 1 was Star Wars.
Yeah.
So now, of course, this doesn't address the idea of, well, Nick, how did the Secret Wars tie-ins do? Well, first off, you're stupid. Of course, they did really, really well, too. But secondly, sorry to offend you with point one, Secret Wars, obviously, as you can tell, sold amazingly well.
Yeah.
Amazingly, amazingly well.
But
that's not to take anything away from it, and Mike will tell you that it was a good book.
Really, I mean,
but I'm here to tell you that even crappy events sell
that's
well.
That's true.
Yeah, that you're not wrong. And there's a certain element of people think that they're going to be more collectible, and they definitely play their advertising off that. Like the PR stuff is like, oh, this is a big thing, a once in a lifetime, and so forth.
Not to mention the variants and the, like, you know,
exactly.
1 in 50 variants and things like that, like the exclusives for various, you know, comic shops.
Oh, like
all
even
that
the
stuff.
The Dark Knight 3 madness of variants.
Yeah.
Last summer's Secret Four thing was when I completely bailed on the top 2 and just went all in on Image and became their spokeswoman for a while. So. Because, I wasn't having it. I was just like, I can't do this. And was not interested in any of the Battle World stuff. And
So to swing this back to, you know, tying back into marketing and things like that, I mean, how are these companies, and to try to wrap us up, how are these companies, you know, using their marketing and their, I guess, their PR to try to sell these books? I mean, it's obviously they aren't going to say, well, the last one was really bad, so buy this new one, it's going to be better. I mean, what do they do to try to differentiate these events to say, oh, this one's going to be different, this one's going to be all new, this is going to be all different, to parody Marvel there for a second.
So a big thing now has been, so when you go and do what I did, where you get your degree in advertising and public relations, now they are joint degrees because they have merged so heavily that it used to be you had your advertising team and you had your public relations team and they were completely separate. But now because of the way the internet works and social media and everything, you end up just having one team and you want people to do both. So it has gone down to the collegiate level where now schools just offer the single degree, because they're so closely entwined, you can't separate them anymore. So a big thing of what they're doing for these events that I know everyone will recognize as soon as you talk about is they have creators are contractually obligated at this point to mostly, I mean, some of them bargain their way out of it. If you're a big enough name, you can, you know, you bargain in your contract. I'll take less money if I don't have to do this, or so on and so forth. But the vast majority of them are obligated to maintain a social media account, and that'll be really explicit which social medias they're required to do and how often. But to do that, to boost their own stuff. So that's why you see Scott Snyder constantly talking about being excited to work with so-and-so on this and so-and-so. And there will...
Don't bring Scotty into this. Scotty does everything out of the goodness of his heart.
Well,
Scotty,
you want to think that all of this stuff is just pure excitement. And, you know, when they're tweeting pages and when they're on Facebook, you know, talking to fans. But even engagement rates can often be required in contracts. So that is a big part of promotion at this point that you might not think of as advertising, but that is, and it's public relations technically, but that is a big, big way now that they're promoting stuff. Another big way is reaching out directly to bloggers and what you call brand ambassadors and getting them to talk about stuff. And that is, if you are a nerd, a quick and dirty way to make a lot of money. If you have X number of dedicated followers on your website or YouTube or what have you, regardless of industry, really, that has become a main way that people sell stuff. You know, you reach out to the mommy bloggers to sell your diapers. You reach out to your lifestyle bloggers to sell your wine. And the same is true for comic books, where you get your big name YouTubers and review sites to talk about your event. And essentially, you're hyping it. So, and generally, when you do a contract like that, like if I'm paying you $10,000 to write X number of articles and whatnot about my thing, it is, you're contractually, you can't write about the competition. So like, if I'm paying you to talk about DC Rebirth, you're not going to see articles on that same site about the other stuff.
Like Marvel Image, all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you can still see it, but it usually is about the direct competition. So if it's event versus an event, so that they can still, you know, maintain their website. So let's say that you have a blog where you talk about throwing house parties and I want you to promote my wine in it. Well, then I would, part of the contract is that you can't, when you talk about wine in your dinner parties, can't talk about other brands of wine. And the same is true for comic book websites and YouTube and, you know, all the other things like podcasts are a big thing now too. And getting your creators on different podcasts and...
Let me just make this clear. I Read Comic Books has none of these types of affiliations, so we will gladly shit or promote any kind of...
Yeah, no, we're way too small. When you're talking about this kind of thing, they're the people who have, you know, thousands or millions of hits on their stuff.
Yeah, we're not there yet, but we're trying, people. Tell your friends.
That's right. Let's do this. We want the contracts. But so if you're wondering who has these things, they are legally obligated to put... in what is often the world's tiniest and most impossible to read font, sponsored by so-and-so or what have you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it kind of makes you wonder, especially with like the DC announcements, and we've seen this in the past with other things as well, a lot of these announcements end up getting delayed for certain conventions. And so you have to wonder if the convention is getting a certain cut or if the convention is being like, you know, if I mean, they obviously must be getting some sort of a boost because of that.
Well, I don't know if it's after Rebirth was cut, but it's probably just whenever people are, you know, the most eyes are going to be looking at conventions for announcements.
Yeah, you already have reporters there. Yeah,
exactly. really.
There's an added allure. I mean, I remember when they announced the Rebirth books, and everyone went batshit insane, and they were like, when are we going to find out the teams? Mm-hmm. And almost immediately, DC was like, well, if you've ever heard of WonderCon, it's going to be at WonderCon. Yeah. So go to WonderCon.
Sometimes, I don't know how often this happens, but I know that sometimes conventions will pay publishers to wait and do that because you're then promoting the con itself, so it'll kind of work the other way around where they're like, please do a big announcement at our thing, here's some money, or do a deal where like you don't have to pay for your vendor space if you'll do a thing like this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So with that being said, if anybody out there who's listening happens to see some sort of crazy article that it was like, I guess it's called like native advertising, isn't it? Where they'll write an article that's sponsored, but it's not actually sponsored in a weird way. Send it our way, because the more ridiculous these types of things get, the more I want to be able to just pick them out. So if you find anything that's absolutely crazy and then you realize that it was sponsored, let us know, because comic book related or not.
The really scary thing, they're getting even harder because now one of the ways that publishing sites, whether it's the New York Times or BuzzFeed or Comic Book Resource, one of the ways they're now making money, because people don't want to buy traditional ad space anymore, like your normal like sidebar, you know, type ads, because they just don't work. When you look at the numbers, they are just not worth the money much anymore. One of the way they're keeping their sites up is by selling these native advertisings, and part of the package is that they write it. Their own writers are writing the stuff. So like the author will be the same person you always read, and you respect their opinion or whatever, and you think it's just another one of their articles. But if you look for that tiny little, you know,
at the very bottom, this article is sponsored advertising, and it's like, I've already read the whole thing. Fuck.
It'll just be, say, like, sponsored by so-and-so. Sponsored. Yeah. And, yeah. There's a lot of legal debate right now about, is this deceptive advertising? Does it there are laws out there about deceptive advertising. And does it qualify? And where's that line? Because the reason it works, you can't argue that people understand what it is, because the reason it works is because people don't recognize it as ads. And as soon as they do, it will stop working. But that's why, you know, your sidebars stopped working, is because people see them as ads. And as soon as they do, they stop being very effective. Your eye skims over them. So the reason they work is people think it's the normal stuff and it's not. And so that, in my opinion, is how is that not the definition of deceptive?
Yeah.
But it is currently what is keeping sites like the New York Times afloat. So that's the other thing. That's
Let's
the flip side.
Put out some shots fired on that.
Yeah. But it is. No, there's been. They've put out their own articles about it, Nick. Like, it's a big deal.
So now they've created a whole sub-industry of themselves writing about themselves?
I can see what you mean. Yeah, no, I don't know. But they...
Oh, my goodness.
They did a very interesting article about this whole issue and then threw in there, like, in all fairness, we do this. Our own journalists write these articles, and this is part of how we can keep, you know, our publication afloat in this age of dying newspapers. So,
yeah, I'll be on the lookout for that next, you know, DC Rebirth sub, you know, article that just happens to subtly mention it and posts a link to some external DC website.
The biggest one right now is BuzzFeed. This is like their bread and butter. And so you'll get a list of like the top 10 villains of all time. And you're like, wow, like 8 of these are DC. And the 2 biggest ones are the ones they're doing a movie about. What is the odds? Yeah. And you're like, oh, I know what the odds are. But
this case in point why I don't read BuzzFeed in the first place. So,
but they have the best listicles.
Oh, but
where do you get your gifts? I'm so confused.
I utilize external third-party services that have like trustworthy networks of information. That's, I mean, come on.
Okay, now shots are fired.
Ooh, better put on my glasses. Mike Rappin's gonna take us to school.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. If you want to send us your thoughts on comics or just say hi, you can email the show at ircb@destroythesaib.org. We're also on Twitter and Tumblr, and we even have our own subreddit. And in case you missed it, our new site for the podcast is live, has all of our episodes, and places for you to leave comments on those episodes. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Esta and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Esta on Bandcamp at esta.bandcamp.com. And you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.bandcamp.com. If you're looking for new podcasts, check out the Podern Family hashtag on Twitter. With thousands of creators, you can find almost any type of podcast that you're looking for. Check it out and support small podcasts like us. Finally, if you like the show, tell someone about it or rate us online. Help spread the word about the show and give us feedback about the program we make. Otherwise, come chat with us online. We'd love to hear what you think about comics. And from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I think Paul is—he's been live tweeting from that Marvel live thing at Van Andel Arena. I don't know if you guys have seen any of that, but it's too funny. You'll have to take a look at his Twitter. He's been sending out pictures of all of the characters and everything. So mainly,
wait,
I think
what
he
is?
Was,
I've never even heard of this Marvel live.
Well, I would say, don't you watch television? But no one watches television. I only occasionally run into it when I'm over at my parents, and they're like, "We want to watch the news," and I'm like, "That means watching commercials." No. And then, but the positive is you learn about dumb shit like that, and also Jack's Wholesale Windows, which if they want to sponsor us, then I'm not going to say anything more about their commercials other than that they're wonderfully cheesy. You just got a free plug, so there you go. No, it's an event at Van Andel, and it's kind of, you know, it's like everybody dressed up in costumes, and I don't really know much more than that. But
kinda
it's like
a Disney on Ice
stage play, probably. Okay. Yeah, maybe like Spider-Man, what, turn out the lights, except no one dies. Just kidding. I don't think anyone died. If anyone died,
two people died, dude.
Wait, what, really? No.
Yeah.
People got injured. Nobody died, right?
I thought that one of the dudes that got injured died.
Oh, man.
I don't even know what you're talking about. I'm so lost.
There was a stage play, and I think Bono and The Edge were in charge, and yep. It was in New York, and it involved a lot of, like, high wire cords and shit, and people started getting hurt a lot. Interestingly enough,
they
gave
their lives
trivia,
for Spidey. That's awesome.
kinda. I mean, I heard it was a mess of a show, just, like, awful everything.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever... this is weird trivia, and I think I've got this right, Mike, but the guy who played... what is that? What's the book about the portrait? Dorian Gray? The guy who played Dorian Gray in Pretty Deadly, I believe, was actually the male lead as Peter Parker in Turn Off the Dark.
Really?
So there's your weird thing. And
that's very weird.
Now I'm on Wikipedia, nervously trying to figure out if I just made jokes about someone biting it, but it looks like people just got hurt.
Oh, okay. Then I misheard.
Yeah, I'm not certain. Whatever. Anyway, that was a mess. So
I was actually listening to a podcast the other day, and it was a I don't remember, it was a comic book podcast, or it was some nerd podcast. There were just people that you would expect to have like a lot of comic knowledge and nerd cred or whatever you want to call it, and they were like, yeah, I wonder if there's ever been a Marvel musical, and I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this was 4 years ago. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like I remember that being on like major news sites that it was a big deal, not just CBR and niche sites, but like big major news outlets were covering that. So I'm kind of surprised that nobody remembers that.
Oh, it was a big deal for a while there. I mean, obviously, a lot of the late-night TV shows were mining it for a lot of laughs.
Yeah, and so was SNL. Like, that's the thing. Like, how could you avoid hearing about that, I guess? Or maybe it's just really easy to forget. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, these days it only takes 1 or 2 days to not be news anymore, so...
Right.
Yep.